This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From the High Center Studios of Messiah College on the frozen pond of Grantham, Pennsylvania, this is the Wave Improvement Leads Home podcast, a bi-weekly discussion dedicated to American history, historical thinking, and the role of history in our everyday lives. And now, here's your host, author and award-winning historian, John Fia.
Thank you, Drew, and welcome to episode 35 of the Wave Improvement Leads Home podcast. I like that, Drew. What did you say? The frozen pond. The frozen pond, right? It's got that old feeling of, you know, like across the frozen tundra. Or whatever. We don't have a pond here on campus, but we have a creek.
We do.
Right? I guess you could play hockey on that.
It didn't really freeze, though.
So, Drew, I imagine you are a hockey fan.
I am.
And your favorite team? Let me guess. St. Louis Blues, right?
You got me. Yeah, as listeners are sure to know, I'm first and foremost a baseball fan, but I was a two-sport kid at a time when St. Louis was, like today, since the Rams bolted back to L.A., a two-sport town. So I really was, as a kid, a baseball and hockey fan, primarily.
What about basketball? Were you a fan of the old ABA St. Louis Spirit? Was that their team? Connie Hawkins?
John, I don't want to date you, but I wasn't alive yet.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. In spite of that, despite not knowing how to skate and being the worst player on my little league team, I had big dreams of being a two-sport pro hero, playing for shortstop for the Cardinals and right wing for the Blues.
St. Louis is a big hockey town.
It is a big hockey town, and you know, in the 90s was a great time. Although we are one of those NHL teams that has never hoisted the cup. Early 90s were fun because that's when we had Adam Oates, Brendan Shanahan, Curtis Joseph, and most importantly, my all-time favorite player, Brett Hull.
Brett Hull, yeah. I mean, like, you think today, there's so many teams out there now. I get confused. I'm not a big hockey fan. You know, I'll watch it. I don't follow it really closely. So I get confused now when I see these southern cities and, you know, I mean, I'm still old school. I'm old enough to, like, you know, it's, you know, you all the Canadian cities, they get a free pass, right? Toronto, Winnipeg, you know, Montreal, and then, you know, you got the standards, right? New York, St. Louis, Detroit, right? It just, they're all these San Jose, and isn't there a Dallas? Dallas has been around for a while.
But that was a team that moved there from Minnesota.
That's right. Minnesota North Stars
moved down to Dallas.
And, yeah.
You know, for a long time, St. Louis was the only city that actively participated and had a long tradition of hockey that was outside of kind of the frozen, frozen cities of the North. How about you? Are you a fan? New Jersey?
Well, like I said, I follow it. I try to follow it. I'll watch a game every now and then. Growing up, actually, I was a Boston Bruins fan. And it's just really weird. I was a Boston Bruins fan because I love to play goalie. I'll talk a little bit about this in my commentary. And they had a goalie named Jerry Cheevers. Jerry with a G. Cheevers. And he had this mask. Some of you are old enough to remember this. He wore that kind of, what was it? What was that? What were those old masks made of? Like fiberglass or something with all the X's, the black X's all over. I thought that was so cool. And growing up in an Italian American kind of household, I always liked Phil Esposito. He had a brother named Tony who played for the Blackhawks, I think it was. I think I got that wrong. Someone tell me if I did. But then, like, during the 80s, I jumped on the Islanders bandwagon, you know, when they had those great teams in the 80s. I liked the Devils for a while. I got to admit, I was rooting for, I rooted for the Rangers. So as you can tell, like, you know, I don't have deep, deep loyalties because no New Yorker like says one year you're rooting for the Rangers and one for the Devils. It's just, that's like a Mets Yankees thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I'm actually really looking forward then to our episode today, because we're going to, if you haven't figured this out yet, we're going to be talking hockey. And our guest is going to be Bruce Berglund. He is working on a fascinating project about global hockey, the globalization of hockey. I think whether you're a hockey fan or not, I think you're going to find this conversation with Bruce to be very interesting.
I might add that Bruce Berglund is our second return guest.
That's right. Amy Bass, who, remember, a few episodes ago, we talked to her about her new book on this incredible team of soccer team of Somalian refugees in Maine. She was our first return guest. Now, Bruce is back. He was our guest on episode 18. We talked to him about his new book at the time, Castle and Cathedral in Modern Prague, Longing for the Sacred in a Skeptical Age. And for a non-American subject, we actually got a lot of positive feedback about that episode. And if I remember correctly, we may have even talked at the end of the interview about his current project on hockey in that podcast.
Yeah, we touched on it just briefly. So I think this is a good time.
Yeah.
Playoffs are about to start. So I think this is a great time to bring it back.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's a good time to talk about hockey here as we approach the playoff season. Well, I know that Bruce was in South Korea for the Olympics in February. So I'm eager also to hear about that, get a report on how this project is moving. But before we get to Bruce, Drew, tell us how we can connect, tell our listeners how they can connect with the podcast.
The Wave Improvement Leads Home is a proud member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Head to recordedhistory.net to check out some of our fellow network podcasts. Particularly, I want to highlight today, Second Decade. It's a fascinating podcast that explores broadly the history of just the second decade of the 19th century. I think it's a very fruitful approach. Host Sean Munger covers global topics while exploring the interconnected nature of the era. And it's also beautifully produced. They have voice actors reading primary documents and good mood music. So, it's a great listen.
So they don't just wing it like us.
No. So, and then as always, we want to give a shout out to our sponsors. Our podcast is brought to you through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi, Ron Schooler, Kate Logan, and Gretchen Adams. And as always, many thanks to Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. If you want to become a sponsor of the show, please head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support. And the best way to spread the word about the podcast is to take it to social media. So again, follow us at TWOILH Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. And consider giving us a positive review on iTunes or Stitcher. Those reviews are clutch. Also, since it's relative to this episode, I need to call out one of our donors, David Onion. Apparently, he's a Dallas Stars fan, and he keeps tweeting disparagingly about my Blues as we're both fighting for that last coveted wild card spot, at least at the time of this recording. So stop it, David. I'm still mad at the Stars for taking away my beloved Brett Hull in 1998. Also, thank you for supporting the show.
Thank you, by the way, to everybody who supports the podcast. We really appreciate your support. You know, every now and then on the blog, I'll blog something out and then tweet it out. We still could use your support. You know, again, we're on a shoestring budget here. We produce this thing episode to episode. We have some great guests lined up for the rest of season four. We're hoping we can make those episodes happen, and we could use your support to help us do that.
Bruce Berglund will be with us soon, but first, you have a story for us, John.
I grew up in an ice skating family, but I was never much of an ice skater. Nevertheless, I spent many winter afternoons playing hockey on the frozen pond at Massar Park, a small township park created out of a sand lot that my mother's family sold to the community when I was a little boy. Though I am certain that skating and pond hockey did not dominate my life in the same way that it would have if I had grown up in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Canada, it was still a rite of passage. As soon as the weather turned cold, we would grab our skates, gloves, and sticks, jump on our bikes, and ride over to Massar Park a few miles away. As I envision those afternoons in my mind, I see the drab sky of a North Jersey January, its lack of color matching the grayness of the ice. I remember trying to sneak in one more game before daylight faded away and we could no longer see the puck. I can still feel the intensity of the cold on my face. The bike ride home always seemed a lot longer than the ride to the park, and I'm sure the wind in our faces did not make it any easier. Dinner awaited, but so did homework. Those days of pond hockey still reverberate in the life of my family. My brother was a phenomenal skater who always impressed the older kids with his speed and stick handling. He passed this along to his son, my nephew, who is currently bouncing around the junior leagues in the United States and Canada, trying to find a path to a professional hockey career. Since I could not skate very well, I always ended up playing goalie. I was the great protector of a cage made with old 2x4s and used wire from someone's chicken coop. Some days I did not even wear skates. I just stand in front of the goal and slide around on the ice in my Chuck Taylors. We had a rule at Massar Park: no lifting the puck. Since I wore no helmet or pads, this kept me reasonably safe. But every now and then I would come home with bruises or a black eye. At some point, my father took me to Marcello's Sporting Goods store in downtown Boonton, New Jersey, to buy me a goalie stick. I remember being upset that the only brands Marcello carried were Coho and CCM. I wanted a Northland goalie stick because that was the brand used by Jim Craig, the goalie of the gold medal winning United States Olympic team in 1980. Craig was my hero. I wrote papers about him in school and in a pre-internet age did my best to learn everything about his life. Some of it was not very inspiring, I might add. There was a brief period when I seriously thought I could be the starting goalie for either the 1984 or 1988 U.S. Olympic hockey team. I'm sure if I dig deep enough in my parents' attic, I will find the notebook in which I recorded, step by step, the training schedule that would one day get me to Sarajevo or Calgary. First, of course, I would need to learn how to skate. As I look back on my childhood days playing pond hockey at Massar Park, I realize that I was completely oblivious to the social and cultural factors that made this possible. I was part of a working-class family, but we lived in a suburb of New York City, and my father made enough money to buy me and my two brothers skates, sticks, gloves, and pucks. I have no doubt that a healthy dose of nationalism inspired my love of hockey, especially after 1980, when the U.S. Olympic hockey team upset the Soviet Union. I'm not an expert on climate change, but I imagine that the ice stayed frozen longer in the 1970s and early 1980s. I lived in an age when there were no cell phones, video games, or laptops to keep us entertained. When we got off the bus after school, we ran home, changed out of our school clothes, and went outside and got some kind of exercise. It was hockey and basketball in the winter, tackle football in the fall, baseball on the cul-de-sac in the spring, and wandering in the woods or riding bikes around the neighborhood all summer. I was a white working-class boy in northern New Jersey, and I imbibed the good and the bad of that kind of upbringing. And I am still not much of a skater.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our guest today is Bruce Berglund, professor of history at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He has published extensively on nationalism, religion, and architecture in 20th century Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. He is the co-editor of Christianity and Modernity in Eastern Europe from Central European University Press, 2010, and the author of Castle and Cathedral in Modern Prague, Longing for the Sacred in a Skeptical Age. He is currently writing a history of world ice hockey and the globalization of sport, be published as part of the University of California Press series, Sport in World History.
Our guest today is no stranger to the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. Bruce Berglund was on a previous episode talking about his book, The Castle or Castle and Cathedral in Modern Prague. But today we are talking with Bruce about his new project on global ice hockey. So, Bruce, welcome back to the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
Now, you have been on the road studying ice hockey. And its yes. sort of global significance. Tell us a little bit about like tell us about the project. How did it evolve? What got you interested in this subject? I know you're a native Minnesotan, so this might have something to do with it, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll tell you briefly about the project and my travels. So this is going to be a book on the history of global ice hockey going back to its origins in the 19th century, and it's going to go up to 2018 at least, and maybe beyond that. And so, of course, I can't cover every little town in North America and Europe where hockey has been played. I'm concentrating on particular regions. So right now I'm actually in Slovakia, but I've been, for the last month in the Czech Republic doing research there in archives and libraries. Earlier in the year, I was in Korea, leading up to the Winter Olympics. Later in the spring and in the summer, I'll be in Canada. So both in Eastern Canada and Ontario, as well as out in Calgary and Edmonton. And of course, I've done a good bit of research in the U.S., in Minnesota and Michigan,
sure.
different collections and archives there. So as far as how the project evolved, so John, you said I'm a native Minnesotan. I actually grew up in Duluth, which is one of the hearths of American hockey going back to the turn of the century. So I grew up just a block away from a public park where there was a hockey rink and a big skating rink. So I went up there a lot. I played organized hockey as a kid up until I was in high school. I wasn't very good. It was just kind of medium. My dad, however, was a very good hockey player. He was also a hockey referee for high school and college when I was a kid. So I remember tagging along with him when he would go referee games, and I would watch him in action. So I watched him ref. I watched him play in senior league games. He and I watched a lot of high school and college games together. So I grew up with the sport. I knew the stories. I knew the lore. I knew the history of the sport. But in terms of thinking of hockey and sports in general as a topic of research and history, this wasn't something that really came to me until I was doing my dissertation research. So this was in 1997-98 in Prague. And of course, that was the year of the Winter Olympics in Nagano, which the hockey tournament was won by the Czech Republic and the first tournament with NHL players. That's right. And so I remember just, what a tremendous atmosphere that was, the euphoria of, thousands, tens of thousands of people out in the streets and the squares and in Prague and in other cities. And not only with that episode, but I had the chance to go to a couple hockey games in the Czech Republic. And I noticed, people do hockey and being a hockey fan differently than what I'm used to. And so that was my first, you could say, awareness of sports as a right. cultural practice that is affected by particular contexts. And so the project I'm working on now really has its roots back, 20 years ago,
yeah.
With my first stay in the Czech Republic back in 98.
Yeah. Now, some of our listeners probably know nothing about hockey, and they're getting an education here. You said hockey, that your project starts in the 19th century.
Yeah.
I should probably know this, Drew. What are the roots? Like, where was hockey founded? Like, what is it? A European? Is it Canadian? What are the roots? So if you could give me like a quick primer on this, where?
No, I can't give you a quick primer. I mean,
it's impossible.
You just open up a can of worms.
Uh-oh.
akin to where does baseball come from, John?
Yeah. But where's
you, can you answer that with a quick primer?
Yeah, no, but I mean, isn't it? I mean, I'm assuming the United States, right? But what?
No,
what?
No. Canada is rightfully known as the birthplace of hockey, of the modern sport of hockey. So it's the rules of the game. The early rules of the game were set down in the 1870s. There's been great debate since the 1870s as to where the game had its origins, whether in Nova Scotia or in Kingston, Ontario, or in Montreal. But wherever you look, there are, antecedents to the modern sport across Canada into colonial America. Over in the British Isles, you have a variety of different kinds of, just as with baseball, you have a variety of different early kinds of games played on ice with skates, with you could say early or primitive skates with some type of stick, with a goal, and usually with a ball. So what becomes known as, and the Europeans, when they begin to play this sport at the turn of the century, they call it Canadian hockey. What is distinct about Canadian hockey is that it's played on a smaller rink. Prior to this time, people would play these skate, stick, and goal games on rivers, on frozen soccer fields, and so forth. So the Canadians invent a game that's in a smaller and more confined space, and the Canadians' great invention that they bring to the game is the puck, rather than playing with a ball, and also that brings a change to the stick. So sticks prior to that had been curved, more like lacrosse or field hockey sticks, whereas at the turn of the century or in the 1880s, 1890s, you begin to get the characteristic bladed, flat-bladed hockey stick. So, yeah, so that's where it begins to develop, is back in Canada in the 1870s, 1880s, and then it spreads quickly from eastern Canada to Manitoba, down into Minnesota, into New England, and it jumps over to England and then to the continent right away in the 1890s.
So it is a North American phenomenon, if you will, at least in its origins.
I would say it's much like baseball in that, yes, it's North American, but it's built upon a European and a specifically British foundation.
Is it an inherently sort of white sport? Did Native Americans play some form of it, or?
Drew's
mad at me because I stole his question. Yeah, but go ahead.
According to some historians who study the origins of the sport, they see its roots. Well, you can see its roots from a couple of different sources. One is that it's derived from rugby. And so the early forms of hockey, you couldn't pass forward. There still is an offside rule and so forth. And hockey was the modern sport was invented by young Canadian, white Canadian men who were looking for something to do in the winter when they couldn't play rugby. The other root of the sport is from the native Canadian sport of lacrosse.
Right.
And so people who look into the roots of the early game can see traces of both influences.
And there's a history to the manufacturing of the sticks, right? Because the sticks were predominantly made by the Mi'kmaq indigenous nation in Canada. At least that's my understanding of.
Yeah. That's right. Yes.
So, which would then connect it to lacrosse and other indigenous sports.
Exactly.
So this is kind of really fun and interesting kind of knowledge about the history of sports. History of hockey. What about, your project is on global hockey. Tell us about the sort of deeper issues here at stake in this project. You know, what are some of the questions outside of kind of hockey as a sport that you're asking in this project?
Well, so what I'm looking at with this project, so one, I'll say there have been plenty of books and articles, popular history, scholarly histories about hockey in Canada, the NHL, amateur hockey, and so forth. There has been very little done on hockey as a world sport. Right. And so very little done with archival sources, with library sources, say from Russia or from Europe. And at the same time, there's been a lot of research in the last 15 years or so on the history of sports done by area specialists, so people who know local languages and so forth, on different sports in different world regions. So baseball in East Asia, the 1972 Olympics in Germany. There are books on soccer in France, soccer in Africa, soccer in Latin America, but nothing on hockey. So what I'm doing is aims to fill a gap both in the literature on hockey as well as in the literature on world sport. And so what I'm looking at is part of the project. So it's about global hockey, but the main aim is looking at hockey as a case study in understanding globalization, and in particular, the globalization of sport is the direction I'm going with my research.
So tell us a little bit about that. What is that? You know, what are the kind of questions that you're asking? You know, how does your project look different than, say, you know, that book on the 72 Olympics or something like that? You know, you're obviously looking for kind of, you know, similarities between hockey as a sort of global phenomenon rather than the particularities of local traditions, right? So how do you know, what kind of questions are you asking of your sources?
Yeah, so one of the things I'm looking at is exactly what you were saying is where do you see, and this has been interesting as I've been doing my research over here, is where do you see kind of local practices maintaining resilience over the decades, as opposed to, you could say, more international influences, whether influences coming from Canada, which was particularly strong in the early 20th century, and then after the war, influences coming from, in particular, the Soviet Union. And by this, I mean practices in terms of how do you train athletes? How do you train hockey players? How do you conduct your practices? How do you play the game? How does the strategy work when you get onto the ice? And so that's been the interesting thing I've been looking at, are these tensions between local practices, whether in the Czech Republic or Slovakia or up in Finland, between, you could say, local sport tradition and local sporting culture, and what is coming from both the West and from the East in terms of, you could say, the larger trends in the way hockey is practiced. So those are the things. Yeah, so those are the things I'm looking at. But you know, in terms of thinking of globalization, that's such a big, you know, amorphous term, and I have tried to come up with something of a definition based on my reading, and you know, mainly in the social sciences. And so my 4 points in terms of what I'm looking at is number one, globalization means that we have interconnection across nations, across different world regions, along with the movement of goods, services, money, information, and people, right? So that's basic. Number two, we have the expansion of institutions, the expansion of social relations around the world, with the result being that different practices and what we would call, I guess, values are diffused around the world. Number three is that changes in society and in culture become more accelerated due to advances in technology and communications. This would be a case in point. We're having a podcast interview while I'm sitting in Slovakia.
Right.
And then lastly, number four, and I think this is really key, especially when we think of sports and sports culture, is that we are aware we're global, right? We all know that events on the other side of the world affect our local politics, they affect our local economies, they affect the fabrics of our communities. And, you know, and you can see this in probably in your classes, right? That, you know, Today, how many students did you see wearing soccer shirts from the English Premier League?
Yeah. I don't think any, but that doesn't mean they're not out there.
Yeah, but it's pretty common.
Go ahead. Sorry. We could cut that.
You know, so, but it's a pretty common occurrence, right?
No, you're right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so looking at sport and looking specifically at hockey, you know, so how do I see these four aspects of globalization shaping hockey, yeah, shaping sport, and at the same time, how do I see sport and specifically hockey? Do we see them, these games bringing about changes in these different aspects of globalization? That's kind of the big questions that are driving my work.
So when you study, say, like the Slovakian hockey style, right? They're the way they play. This is literally a study of the actual, right? You said strategy before, right? You know, are you suggesting that, you know, the way the Slovakians play defense or pass the puck or the speed of the game or something, the way they play kind of might reflect kind of larger questions, yeah, about their culture and their, am I right in that?
Yeah.
You know, that's fascinating.
And people who, and there's an argument about this, right?
Yeah.
This goes back and forth. And we see the same with, baseball. We see the same with, with soccer. There are some who say that yes, when a soccer player, for instance, has the ball, you know, the field is open, the decision that player makes of what to do with the ball is shaped by culture.
That's fascinating.
And then there are academics, yeah, who say, no,
yeah,
the whole idea that there are cultural style or that there are national styles and cultural determinants in terms of what a player is going to do with the ball.
Yeah.
Those are all narratives that are made up by,
yeah, yeah,
by journalists and fans and so forth. But, no, you know, to give you an example, so moving away, yeah, from Slovakia, let's take an example of Finland. And I was talking with some hockey historians up in Finland, and they were pointing out that Finland had actually this strong tradition of not team sports, but individual sports, in particular running and Nordic skiing and, yeah, so forth. Yeah. And so hockey was something of a late arrival in the post-war period, and it didn't really take off until the 1960s. And initially, contrary to all of our stereotypes about Scandinavian hockey, Finnish hockey was much more about individual skill and, you know, so more like North American hockey. And it was only with the influence of coaches coming from the Soviet Union and from Sweden that, yeah, the Finns began to develop more of a team-oriented game. And so the Finns had what we could call kind of a hybrid form of hockey with an emphasis both on individual skill and creativity as well as an emphasis on the team and, say structures, offensive plays and defensive plays and so forth. They developed this hybrid relatively early because it mixed together their, yeah, own sporting culture as well as the influence of coaches coming from the outside.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. That's goes a lot deeper than kind of, you know, what I've often thought about. This sounds like a great book, a great project. And only a scholar of global hockey could make the transition from Slovakia to Finland,
yeah,
right, with such ease.
Yeah. It's funny, and this kind of relates to our next question. I've always, when I've thought about world hockey, I've always just assumed there's the North American style NHL, smaller rink, you know, more aggression, and then the international style with the bigger rink and more kind of finesse. But it seems like it's a little, like most things, it's a little bit more complicated than that, you know, rather than just an NHL versus everyone else kind of divide in the way they.
Yeah. Tomorrow I'm having an interview with a longtime Czech coach. So he's been around since the 1960s, and I've been reading his work that, you know, basically decades before all of the data analysis we see in sports today, you know, with the numbers crunching with baseball and basketball and so forth. He was doing all of this back in the 60s and his analysis of different teams at the World Cup. And I've been reading his reports where, you know, back to your point, Drew, it's not simply Canadians do this and all the Europeans do this. He would break it down by the Swedes and the Finns and the Swiss and the Soviets and the Czechs. We all do these different things. Here's how we here's how we play the game. And then he would have pages and pages of diagrams of the rink, of the offensive zone, the defensive zone, to show the way these different countries played the game.
Well, I mean, this transitions to kind of why I have that perception. It's because I think most Americans, even those of us who are hockey fans, our closest experience with global hockey always comes every 4 years with the Olympics. Yeah. And you know, you were in Korea for the Olympics, so tell us, you know, what you were doing there and how that piece, how that piece fits in with this larger project.
Yeah. So I was, in Korea. I was there for a total of a month. So 3 weeks leading up to the Olympics and then the first week of competition. So I was the guest of the Korean Ice Hockey Federation, as well as Korea University in Seoul. And the work I was doing, I met with different people involved with the Korean Ice Hockey Federation leading up to the Olympics. So I interviewed both members of both the men's and women's Korean Olympic teams. I met with the general manager and the head coach of one of the professional teams that plays in Seoul. There's a professional league that has teams in Korea and in Japan. And so what I wanted to do in the course of these interviews is just get a sense of the development of Korean hockey, not just leading up to the Olympics in Pyeongchang, but also the development of the professional game and then the game in terms of at the youth level, the high school level, and the college level. So I did all those interviews. I met with some members of other national teams who were in Korea for the Olympics, met with some officials from the International Ice Hockey Federation, and then I went to games. So I went to three women's games, three men's games. I went to three games of the Korean women's team, and so you probably all know the story of the North Korean players who joined the Koreans team. So I was at the games when you had those North Korean cheerleaders coming in and sitting in different sections of the crowd. You had kind of this pro unification fan group from various cities in the South who were at the arena chanting along. So it was this really festive, dynamic, energetic atmosphere, even though the women's team was beaten handily in all three games that they played.
Yeah.
It was really this great atmosphere, which turned into kind of a pro unified Korea rally.
Yeah.
And then I went to three men's games, including one of the Korean men's team's games against the Czech Republic, actually.
Okay. I remember seeing something you posted on social media where you, I don't know if it was the men or women's Korea team, but you said something like somebody told you, I think it was Japan, right? If the Korean team could beat Japan, that would be like their miracle on ice. Is that, did you post something like that? That was a great story.
Yeah, I posted that. Yeah. And for when I was meeting with people involved with the professional, the men's professional team based in Seoul, that was something they talked about as well, that as they develop their team and develop their program, the aim was not winning the league. The aim was beating the teams from Japan,
right?
First, if we can beat the teams from Japan here in Korea, that's one step. Then if we can beat the teams from Japan in Japan, that's an even better step. So Japan was the, has been the measure of hockey success for the Koreans.
Okay. Now, by this point in the interview, we've talked about things like globalization and so forth. What are some of the other outside forces that affect sort of global hockey? I remember reading you sent along a summary of your project to us before the interview. you know, there was some stuff in there about climate change. I want to ask you about class, social class here in a second. I mean, what are some of those kind of macro forces that you're looking at in this project, apart from globalization sort of generally, that shape hockey around the globe?
Well, so you've mentioned a couple of them that are key. So, yeah. so one is climate change.
Right.
So when hockey develops in the late 19th, early 20th century, this is a different, this is really the tail end of the Little Ice Age, right? So in North America, as well as in Europe, you have much colder winters. So you can have, even in England, you can have outdoor ice. You know, you've probably seen pictures of people skating in Central Park, right? In the 20s and 30s and so forth. People used to go skating regularly in the 1920s and 30s on the mall, you know, on the reflecting pool in Washington, D.C., right? Something you can't do anymore except in the rarest of winters.
Right.
So, you know, over the course of the 20th century, as the climate has warmed up, this has brought a change in hockey, in that hockey has had to, in order to survive, move indoors. And as it's moved indoors into arenas with refrigerated rinks, this has also allowed hockey to spread into areas, into southern states in the United States, into other countries where you wouldn't have ice. So the game is spreading in terms of its geography. The game is spreading in terms of on the calendar. You can now have hockey in the summer if you play it inside.
Right.
And that has brought a shift in the game. And we're still kind of going through, as I've been doing interviews with former players, with current coaches, with NHL scouts, you know, kind of with people my age and older, the old curmudgeons, you know, who grew up playing the game outside, they're kind of having a difficult time going through this change as hockey has become wholly a game played inside and a game played in places like Vegas and Arizona and Korea and Mexico.
So, so with this, change in climate, you also talk about in your summary of your project pond hockey, and I was unaware that this was a real thing other than just kids,
it's a huge thing,
kids getting out there and playing right after school or whatever or on Saturday. It's a huge thing, and how does climate affect that? I mean, I know there's obvious reasons, but maybe you could extrapolate a little bit.
So pond hockey was something that you did as a kid or as a teenager, right? It was just, you know, an idle activity. You'd go out and skate. It was unstructured, right? But now there is, you know, and I would say it's due to both climate change as well as the professionalization of youth hockey, where youth hockey is now so highly organized and coached. As well as just the expansion of the NHL into this multi billion dollar business, that there's this nostalgia to go back to kind of the roots of the game.
Yeah.
And the roots of the game are outside on some natural frozen surface. Over the last, it's been about 15 years since the first pond hockey tournament in Canada. So over the last decade and a half, you've had the spread of these organized pond hockey tournaments across all of Canada, throughout much of the northern tier of the United States, and now as well into Europe. And so it's this attempt to capture this nostalgic effort to go back to the game as we remember it. And it's interesting because I've gone to a number of the websites of these tournaments, and nearly all of them have some variation on saying hockey the way it was meant to be played. Yeah, so there's this sense of hockey today that there's something not entirely right with the sport.
Right.
And so by playing pond hockey, even though we have sponsors for our teams, even though we have corporate sponsors for the tournaments, even though it's this entire, you know, this highly organized tournament, we're going back to some kind of primeval form of the game by going out for this tournament.
That's really interesting. One more thing I wanted to ask you about these outside forces. And I'll preface this by saying I have a nephew, my brother's son, who plays hockey. He's yet to go to college. He's 22, 23. He's been bouncing around these junior leagues. He was in, the British Columbia Hockey League. He was playing for a team in Surrey. Then he went to Amarillo, Texas, which, I'm just like, what the heck? There's hockey in Amarillo, Texas. Of course, you just mentioned how it doesn't really matter anymore with the indoor play. But, he's been bouncing around. It looks like he's finally going to kind of give it up and go play in college. But, my brother does very well for himself financially. And, I can't imagine being able to afford on a professor's salary my kids advancing in high, advancing that high in hockey. It's just very, very, very expensive. And the ice time is expensive and so forth. I'm just curious. I mean, what role does social class play like in outside of the United States and Canada, or maybe just outside of the United States? I mean, is hockey a kind of rich kids sport? How does that social class dynamic work in other places?
Yeah, so this is a problem in hockey in the US, in Canada, as well as in Europe. When I talk to people in Korea, they recognize it as a problem there. Okay. So no matter where you go, hockey is expensive because of the equipment, because of paying for the ice time. Time magazine did a report last year on the increasing costs of youth sports. So hockey is the second most expensive on average, the second most expensive sport in the United States. In Canada, costs for extra training and summer camps can bring the price of playing youth hockey up to $15,000 a year.
Yeah.
So there was a great study done or a story done by the Vancouver Sun. So talking about your nephew playing out in British Columbia, which brought up this fact that hockey is becoming a game only for those with the means to play. And it's also, like I said, so this is something that it's been in the Czech media, in the Slovak media.
Okay.
There have been reports in the Russian media where Russian ice hockey officials have had to address this question of, is hockey a sport only for the children of rich families?
Yeah.
In Sweden, it's a problem. So everywhere it's a problem, and everywhere ice hockey federations are trying to address it, and they are doing a good job, I should say, in improving accessibility, right? So allowing young players to get access to the game. The problem that still remains, though, is that for those young players to advance to the top levels, and really to be competitive in a sense that they would, say, get a junior's contract or a professional contract or a college scholarship, is that, and you know about this from being involved in sports with your daughters, right? So this idea that if you want to make it to the next level, you have to pay for all of this extra training and all of these other opportunities.
Yep.
To give your child the chance to compete.
Oh my gosh!
Where the big bills come in for hockey.
Well, the amount of money I've spent on club volleyball, right, and then driving to an elite club in Philly three times a week, 90 minutes. Now just a follow up to that, Bruce. In the Soviet, when the Soviet Empire, the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet Union, was it the same thing? I mean, or was this just, were they just finding like the best talent regardless of privilege or whatever and getting them into the system? In other words, does kind of capitalism or the move to a freer society, does that create these problems now that you're talking about, or have they always been there? Does that make sense?
So, Yeah. But it's also the case. So we see the movement to capitalism, what we would call a neoliberal economy.
Right, right.
Its effect in Europe, its effect in the former Soviet Union. We also see it its effect in North America, right? So you remember growing up, you had a much more, in the United States, you had a much more developed system of public parks, of community activities that were provided by the community.
Right.
Yes, there was probably some nominal fee that parents would have to pay.
Yeah.
And this is something I've learned in the interviews that I've done with former hockey players, you know, especially guys who are older than me, is that they were able to play hockey because of the contributions of the public park system, because of the contributions, say, of local unions that provided the equipment, that took care of the rink. And, you know, just as you don't have the state-subsidized athletic system in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, we also don't have in the United States this, you know, well-supported, publicly funded park system where kids learned not just hockey, but other sports.
This is so interesting, Drew. I mean, this stuff is, you know, I mean, I could just keep, we could just keep talking, but unfortunately, Bruce, our time is up. I still have tons more questions. We'll have to get you back on once the book comes out. And I get a chance to read it and then really kind of dig into some of this stuff. But thanks for giving us this update on the project. I'm really looking forward to reading the book. Our guest today has been Bruce Berglund, professor of history at Calvin College, and a Fulbright scholar studying global ice hockey. Thanks again, Bruce.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, Drew, Bruce is always a great, great interview, and this project sounds really amazing.
Well, I mean, it's interesting how this is connected to some other conversations we've been having. You know, as he was talking about the cultural significance and the cultural differences and the way people play their sports of choice, you know, I couldn't help but think of episode 20, La Vida Baseball, and some of the things that our guest Adrian Burgos Jr. was sharing with us about the kind of Latin approach to baseball and the ways those different approaches sometimes conflict most specifically in the latest World Baseball Classic and the kind of surprise run by the Puerto Rican national team.
Yeah, I mean, these questions that Bruce is asking are sort of, you know, made me think of kind of these old, debates among historians, right? You know, there's this, is there a Finnish way of hockey or a Swedish way? And I'm thinking like, you know, from even your own work, right, about the Pennsylvania frontier, right? Scots-Irish are just always angry or, you know, these people always play that are this way or this way. When ethnicity is often, you know, constructed thing. And I think Bruce's point about Finland kind of being this, you know, kind of amalgam of Russian influences and other kind of Scandinavian influences was really interesting. And it's a great way of kind of getting at these bigger questions that we ask in whether it be Native American studies or colonial America or some other field.
But then it becomes more about the institutions, right?
And
the structures that are putting you, that gets to your question about Soviet hockey and the ways in which a state-sponsored hockey program is different than one in which, class kind of breaks through because there's, you have to pay for it yourself.
Well, like behind that question, you know, was the kind of, you know, me growing up in the Cold War, you know, there was always that question, like class didn't really matter in the Soviet Union. They just took their best players no matter what class they were in, you know, the best athletes, and they put them in a camp for their whole life from as little kids, and they churned out these phenomenal Red Army teams. So it really interests me the way in which, as you know, we could debate just how free Russia has become, right? That's a whole other question. But with the end of the sort of Soviet regime and the emergence of a sort of neoliberal economy or capitalism or whatever you want to call it, how that might affect the ways in which these nations either continue to be on the world stage as global hockey powers or perhaps decline, right? You know, those are all fascinating questions that I hope he unpacks in this project.
Yeah, I just really love the question of kind of national sport cultures. You know, one more kind of anecdote here, you know, that one of my good friends, Trey Overholt, the musician behind Overholt, he was a soccer player here at Messiah. And I know, you know, Messiah's soccer approach, the way they coach their team, is highly influenced by the Dutch national approach to soccer.
Yeah.
So, you know,
but that's also fascinating, like the multi-layered, right? And you could also say that one of the reasons why, you know, Dave Brandt and, you know, the architect of the Messiah program was attracted to the Dutch system was because at a faith-based college, you know, the Dutch system, right, if I understand it correctly, and I'm no soccer expert, is all about sort of sacrificing yourself for the greater good. And, you know, so all of these convergences of religion, you know, strategy, the culture of Messiah College, the how to be successful in their particular division or whatever
because the Dutch soccer team historically has been very, very good, but it's also very systematic. You know, everyone has a role. It doesn't rely on you know, these star players the way, for example, the Brazilian style.
And then you also throw in, say, a coach like Dave Brandt, who has his own style of how he thinks a team should work. And, you know, so you have some human agency there, you have some macro issues, right? And it gets very complicated, like much of history is. So we're looking forward to that book by Bruce. I'm serious about having him back on maybe for a third time once that book comes out, because I'm really looking forward to reading it. I think that's a wrap, Drew, on episode 35. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support. And as always, may your way of improvement lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out the other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice so others may more easily find this podcast. Let's continue the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. The podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, and Ron Schooler. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Studios of Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Bruce Berglund. Our studio producer is Josh Lowry. I've been your producer, Drew Durley Hermeling, and your host is John Fia.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.